Well, hi there. As usual, I'm John Beck, the co-director of our Daily Work and Daily Lives. And I think we're losing out against warm weather. But so we'll get started. Let me make a couple of announcements and then introduce today's speaker. So we're doing a quick turnaround. So our next brown bag is actually on Monday. And Monday, Colin Bossen. Colin's the son of Howard Bossen, who many of you have met in prior brown bags, who's a professor of photographic journalism here at Michigan State, and the co-editor, and you get to be Vanna White now, you get to hold up the book, Bill. You get to, Howard and I, you might remember, brought in Gilles Perrin, and Gilles and his wife, Nicola Wensick, did a brown bag here during their exhibit, Detroit Resurgent, An Extraordinary Document of Our World. So the book is fresh out, just came out, and does have a foreword from President Simon, among other things, an essay by Howard, an essay by me, a poem from one of the portrait subjects, an essay from one of the portrait subjects, and 62 wonderful photographs, and along with interviews with all of the folks. So just thought I would mention that, since all of you, I think, were at that brown bag. But on Monday, Colin Bossen is coming. He's currently at Harvard University in the American Studies Department, but he's going to talk about his prior experience organizing Chicago couriers, bike couriers, into a union in Chicago. And that's the Chicago Couriers Union 2003 to 2010, a case study in solidarity unionism, which I think will be quite interesting. Coming up in April, we have two brown bags to finish the series this year. I've already begun to get some brown bags nailed down for next year, and I think you'll be quite happy, ultimately, with what some of those look like. Bob Morris just wrote a book about his father, Ken Morris, and the rise of the UAW in Detroit. He's going to be coming. We've got Maria Katera from the University of Michigan, who's going to be talking about Chicano Latino workers. We have Michael Honey, who's coming in from the University of Washington, to talk about his new book on John Hancock's and the Southern Sharecroppers Union. Hancock's is a very famous labor troubadour, so Mike is going to be singing as well as speaking about Hancock's. But to finish off in April, we have two brown bags. Jean-Philippe Mathieu is coming in from University of Quebec to talk about labor struggle in both nations, the U.S. and Quebec, I mean in Canada, in the mid-1870s, late 1870s, 1876 through 1878. Specifically, these were, I often, when I lecture, talk about it as the second great American Revolution. There was a nationwide rail strike that virtually paralyzed the United States in 1877 and ended up in armed confrontations in Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and elsewhere, and really quite an amazing strike. It started in Martinsburg, West Virginia, went all the way to San Francisco. And so it's a huge nationwide strike at a time when nothing was really nationwide, in effect. And so it's a fascinating thing about that strike, and I believe the 1878 Quebec general strike, which started on the docks and spread. So very interesting talk by Jean-Philippe on April 4th. Then our last one of the year is Matt Daly coming in from the History Department of Grand Valley to talk about the 1916 Black Friday storm on Lake Erie, which claimed an unbelievable amount of ships and sailors. And he's going to be talking about not only the experience of those ships and sailors, but also the Lake Carriers Association, which was in effect the association of the employers, and how they looked at that specific disaster. Matt's been a brown bag speaker here before, so I think you'll really enjoy that. I also had my assistant Bill handout. The library did a separate flyer for it, so if you have any place to hang up this really nice two-color, you know, green and white and black, multiple colors, in fact, thing, that's just great. So that one's going to be, April 4th is going to be over at the library, so I welcome you to come over there for that talk. So today, we are really lucky. I sat down last night and had a wonderful time over dinner with Matt Peel, who's with the Department of History at Augustana College in South Dakota. Matt got interested in Detroit and specifically the intersection of work and religion and organizational life in Detroit, and he's going to tell us all about that. But just a little bit of background on Matt. Originally from South Dakota, so he returned to his roots to end up teaching. But he went to the University of Minnesota and then on to Brandeis University for his PhD, where he worked with Jackie Jones, among others. So very, very wonderful background in history. He teaches archival courses to his students, so actually has a study away that they do in Washington, D.C., where they go and use some of the finest archives in America, learn how to do archival method, and looking at some study abroad opportunities. So I think he's very, very creative, very, very good historian. I think that you'll enjoy his talk today, which is The Moralistic God in the Factory System, Uncovering Religion in a 1950s Automobile Factory. So please help me in welcoming Matt Peel to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Is this going to cause any feedback? No?
We're good.
Okay. Hi. Well, thanks for coming out today. And thanks to John for inviting me. It's great to be here. Especially great to be in Michigan, talking to Michigan people about a Michigan subject. So let me just quickly frame a little bit of the context for this paper. Normally, I like to be a little more kind of free range. I like if I'm talking before a class, I usually like to have sort of a PowerPoint, and then I just kind of freestyle off of that. But I thought that might risk wasting your time. So I wanted to be clear in having a narrative and sources and give you a sense of kind of the sources that I was finding and thinking about as I was writing the dissertation, which has become a book. And this particular, what I'm going to share with you today is a snippet of something that's going to appear in a longer form as an essay in a collection of essays on working class religion that's forthcoming by the University of Illinois Press. It should be titled Between the Pew and the Picket Line, is sort of the pending title. So if you see that title, if you're interested in this, this will be a kind of a longer form of that. And so this is a very, very small slice of what I discovered was a huge subject. Work and religion. Should probably narrow that down a little bit before you propose it to a thesis committee or try to present it. So what we're seeing is work and religion as understood through one particular group of people with a particular perspective at a particular time. And the people that we're going to be sort of exploring this subject with are largely white, college-educated Protestant ministers who in the mid-1950s decided that they would get jobs on assembly lines at Detroit plants, particularly the Cadillac plant, and that they would sort of labor with labor and share and investigate and do this kind of interweaving of the working class world with the middle class world, and sort of what they would be doing was witnessing and missionizing through the act of laboring with labor. And they call themselves the Detroit Industrial Mission. So that's what we're going to sort of look at today is religion and labor through the lens of these folks here. So I'll insert editorial comment here where I think necessary and sort of give you the overview of the narrative that I have here. So in 1961, the Detroit Industrial Mission published a provocative essay titled Work, Curse or Joy. For the previous 4 years, the Protestant ministers associated with DIM had labored on assembly lines at Detroit area auto plants, assessing and analyzing the impact of industrialization on faith and life, and they had reached what was to them an unsettling conclusion. In general, DIM asserted, quote, workers hate their jobs and find their labors, quote, a distasteful necessity. Managers seemed oblivious or defensive, insisting that of course their workers were happy, or if they weren't happy, they could get another job. Unions, meanwhile, appeared to have adopted the philosophy that, quote, one, Work in most of modern industry is capital H hell. And number two, this essential hellishness cannot be changed. Work, according to union leaders, could be made bearable, but not enjoyable. According to DIM, the entire dilemma stood up, DIM was the acronym that I use here for Detroit Industrial Mission. The entire dilemma stood opposed to, quote, the biblical tradition, for the Bible viewed work as, quote, a source of joy. But joyful work necessarily offers people a chance to become richer, deeper, fuller human beings. So was not something very wrong with the very soul of modern labor, DIM asked, if so many people were dehumanized by their work? DIM's question is age old and persistently troubling. Indeed, it's probably the key question that drew me to this subject in the first place. Is the near universal experience of work a punishment by God for humanity's sinfulness? Or is it a blessed opportunity to grow toward greater purpose, fulfillment, and service? As DIM was learning in the late 1950s, the answer to this question often depended more on the actual social experience of labor than on the theoretical existence of work. In other words, it depended on class. And as DIM's own history illustrates, religion played a vital role in making and shaping social class in the mid-20th century. DIM's own reading of the relationship between religion and class was, not surprisingly, shaped by their own middle-class, highly educated Protestant backgrounds. But nevertheless, DIM's records and publications are an invaluable source for documenting the tangled admixture of religion, labor, and class. As sojourners on the shop floors of America's preeminent industrial metropolis, DIM's ministers provide a rare, detailed, and nearly anthropological portrait of working class religion as it was felt and lived. So let me share a little bit about the background of DIM quickly. It was established in 1956 by the Reverend Hugh White, an Episcopal priest at St. Martin's Parish in Detroit. White was a student of the English Industrial Mission movement and the French worker priests, and was intrigued by trends in European theology, particularly the idea of Christian existentialism and their application to the more immediate worldly problems confronting post-war Detroit. White recruited the aptly, if ironically named, Scott Paradise, who had worked with the Sheffield Industrial Mission in England, to bring his experience to the Motor City. Initially, Paradise found DIM's approach to be, quote, distinctly Episcopalian, but the program rapidly became ecumenically Protestant, and the character of the ministry began to shift as it absorbed and incorporated similar what were called industrial missionary efforts by other mainline Protestant bodies. In particular, of particular importance was a group called the Presbyterian Industrial Project, or PIP. PIP had originated among idealistic and energetic students at Princeton Theological Seminary in 1954. These students, three of them, George Coleman, David Lowery, and Ori Hopper, decided that they wanted to form what they call a triple pastorate in Ecorse, a struggling blue-collar suburb southwest of Detroit, where, in other words, the three pastors would each do different combination of community and pastoral things out of the church. And at the same time that they worked in the church, two other Princeton Seminary grads, again the aptly named, if ironically named, Jesse Christman and Jim Campbell, took factory jobs on assembly lines at the nearby Cadillac plant. They also maintained contact with the Methodist Phil Doster, who took a job at McLuth Steel in 1957 and was later formally adopted into DIM. So the idea is you have a couple of ministers working in the plants, you have another group of ministers working in the church, and together they're going to try to knit these cultural threads together from the world of the plant to the world of the church to the broader society at large. Upon entering the auto plant, DIM's ministers recognized, apparently to their surprise, that religion was ubiquitous. Quote, preachers and factories are not unique phenomenon, they correctly noted. Indeed, DIM's idea of bringing the ministry onto the shop floor was nearly as old as the American industrial system itself. As early as the 1830s, some ministers were holding prayer meetings in industrial workplaces, and the impulse to shape religious messages into worker-specific and even class-conscious contexts gained considerable momentum during the Progressive Era. In Detroit, a number of activists for the budding United Auto Workers, including Lloyd Jones, a one-time self-described Ford preacher from Kentucky, and William Bowman, one of the UAW's first African-American organizers, were either active or former ministers. Claude Williams, the Detroit Presbytery's minister to labor during World War II, formed numerous shop tabernacles in the city's burgeoning war plants to preach a potent blend of Bible-centered political radicalism. And in direct anticipation of DIM, the Methodist Reverend Owen Geer of Dearborn created the Detroit Religion and Labor Seminar in 1946. By 1947, Geer's group was educating over 20 middle-class seminarians in issues of labor unionism and working-class life, including the requirement that seminarians labor at industrial jobs in area factories. This is a pretty clear precursor. DIM, however, appeared fairly oblivious to this history. Instead, and I found this really interesting, DIM's ministers were not struck by their continuity with the past, but by the strangeness of contemporary worker religion and their own estrangement from it. According to DIM, the many, quote, sect group pastors who earned their keep as auto workers dominated religion in the factory. Evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal pastors had indeed been a part of the cultural ecosystem of the auto plants at least since the Southern Great Migration surrounding World War II. In fact, during the war, some observers estimated there were nearly 3,000 evangelical shop floor preachers working at war plants. DIM ministers clearly and emphatically distanced themselves from what they saw as the robust emotionalism and biblical literalism of what they dismissively referred to as, quote, the sects. By contrast, DIM viewed its own religion as a mature and thoughtful expression of the church. DIM ministers saw themselves as very different from their blue-collar fellow pastors. Quote, we didn't preach, they note, or carry Bibles, because they're focused on a conversation rather than preaching. Hyper-conscious of their differences from the workers they aspired to inspire, DIM ministers quickly came to feel that their association with churches produced uneasiness, anxiety, and even a measure of hostility among some workers. Scott Paradise, for instance, sensed a, quote, intense discomfort in his visits to the shop floor. He theorized that the rawness of union politics and the bruising nature of work caused some workers to view him as, quote, a judge, which produced in these workers, quote, an underlying sense of guilt. On the other hand, Paradise also realized that he was often used as a pawn in a game in which some workers would try to playfully embarrass other workers before a perceived symbol of respectability and morality. Workers' views of preachers, Chrisman reported, focused on moralistic behavior and social utilitarianism. Quote, well, they don't go in bars and they don't swear. He's a leader. He sets an example for others. As outliers of shop floor morality, DIM concluded, preachers were common enough but remained essentially outside working class culture. These observations that DIM is making may have been rooted in more complex class-based cultural power struggles than the DIM ministers themselves fully realized. While mid-century auto factories were often described as zones of a kind of secularized rough culture, religion nevertheless remained a vital component in the lives of large swaths of the working class. Workers did not necessarily resent religion itself, but they did resent being preached at, especially by well-meaning outsiders. As Princeton-educated theologians, DIM ministers would naturally arouse the suspicions of workers who might jealously guard the boundaries of their cultural autonomy. This insight explains why, when Campbell's and Chrisman's ministerial background was revealed, the social dynamic immediately shifted. I'm going to quote a large excerpt here of a report that Chrisman wrote. Phil and I were discussing Bible reading, someone else having brought it up. Another worker made several extremely crude remarks about this practice and also about those who engage in it. I asked him why he felt this way and pushed him a little about why he should feel so hostile to the idea that some might find Bible reading helpful. Before I knew it, he was accusing me of trying to get him to go to church and telling others hey, he's trying to get me to go to church. It was almost as if he was saying, now I finally found him out. Perhaps this particular worker genuinely disliked religion and had no personal faith, but his broader message to other workers was clear. Middle-class outsiders are, once again, trying to change and or police our culture. Class and the power structure it represented, not religion, was the real point of contention. Dim's ministers came to feel that workers ultimately held an entirely different conception of religion itself. To Dim, religion was an unfolding intellectual process of searching, questioning, and exploring, not a finished end. But workers' religion, as Dim read it, was a closed system, rigid, literalistic, and moralistic. After inquiring among unskilled and semi-skilled workers about their perceptions of the afterlife, for instance, one Dim minister wrote that workers never gave the issue consideration, quote, unless these thoughts are the naively accepted doctrines of some religious sect or group. Other contemporary ministers who shared similar theological and class backgrounds echoed Dim's conclusions. For instance, Cleo Boyd was a mainline pastor with a declining church in inner city Detroit, who also set out to explore the flourishing storefront tabernacles of Appalachian migrants in 1958. The theology of working class evangelicals, according to Boyd, was, quote, one of old time fundamentalism with a literalistic interpretation of the Bible. These beliefs permeate the society. Their concept of God is that of a stern, punishing God who, for all his severity, holds forth the bright promise of life hereafter to the well-behaved poor. In truth, hundreds of these storefronts existed throughout Detroit in the late 1950s and early 1960s. In a single neighborhood on Detroit's Lower East Side, 42 of 55 churches were in storefronts. Dim ministers worked on assembly lines next to some of these southern-born migrants, but their conceptions of religion, so deeply rooted in class experiences, were worlds apart. Meanwhile, from Dim's perspective, the daily reality of factory work steadily wore away at workers' sense of purpose, vitality, and humanity. Scott Paradise felt that workers were, quote, profoundly ambivalent about life in the plants, taking pride in their job, but despising the labor itself. One man even told him, quote, I die every morning when I come through those gates. Campbell and Chrisman also reported a conversation with one coworker who claimed he hated the plant. Quote, I never tell anyone I work at Cadillac, this worker admitted. I don't guess there are more than four members of my family that know I work in the factory. I even have two sets of wallets and key cases. In Dim's eyes, the combination of a rigidly moralistic and otherworldly religion combined with deadening labor to retard and cripple the spirit of most workers. In 1960, Dim articulated this connection in frank and startling terms in a report that they published in bold-faced caps. The moralist God and the factory system, Dim declared, were one and the same. Let me share with you part of this major report that they wrote where they explain what they're thinking. The religious background of most of the men around us is that of the Southern sect groups. A few have behind them old world Catholicism. Most are estranged in one way or another from this background. They have good reason for leaving it. The religion with which many workers are deeply imbued and from which they have fled but not escaped is the religion of merit, of holiness in moralistic terms, of earned righteousness, of do's and don'ts, mostly the latter. The working man faces the same thing in the work and the religion available to him. God and the factory are one and the same. The man is dominated by them and coerced by him, but he hates them both because they have refused him his manhood. By the fall of 1960, Dim's ministers had come to despair over the possibility of spiritually elevating factory work. And yet, they argued hopefully, quote, we believe that the Christian faith can be relevant to the millions of skilled and unskilled workers in America. This, of course, implies that it wasn't relevant at the time, at least as they understood it. And they don't exactly explain how they're going to make it relevant, but they nevertheless hold out this hope. Interestingly, And this will be kind of the last section of this paper that I'll talk about here. But I find this very interesting, that after 4 years in the plants, between 1956 and 1960, Jesse Chrisman, Jim Campbell, and Phil Doster had undergone their own type of conversion experience. All had become obsessed by the dynamics of class and of the role of religion in shaping the industrial system. Dim's shop ministers argued passionately to their Protestant peers that, quote, a distinct working class existed, as did, quote, a distinct cleavage between the world of the assembler and the world of those economically, vocationally, educationally, and socially above him. These sentiments, as they well knew, were, quote, rather frowned upon in our country. So convinced are we in our idealization of our society that ours is a truly classless society. We should remember, of course, this is at the height of the Cold War. But the ministers' experiences of industrial work had dramatically changed their understanding of the relationship between religion and social class. No longer did they envision Christianity as a universal truth that transcended social division and cultural norms. Instead, they stepped away from their sojourn on the shop floors of Detroit with a jarring sense of the stark particularities and the troubling divide between middle class and working class religion. The evolution in the thinking of Dim's ministers from optimism to confusion to frustration can be observed in rather sharp detail and provides a fascinating microcosm of the power of work to shape culture. During the first months of their employment, Doster, Campbell, and Chrisman agreed that work was ennobling and remained hopeful about the chances for building fellowship and community. Quote, somehow, they wrote, as one walks out of the factory after his shift along with the other workers, there is a deep sense of participation. Perhaps, they added more soberly, this is a romantic reaction soon lost to the man whose stay in the factory lengthens. Indeed, as the ministers experienced the cyclical and unstable nature of auto work, and as they learned more about the work itself, these sentiments faded considerably. All three men suffered periodic, yet unpredictable, bouts of unemployment. Some of what these men experienced was the result of bad timing, because 1957 and 1958 were recession years that hit the auto industry especially hard, and automation was further reducing job roles. On the other hand, auto workers commonly faced unemployment and faced employment insecurity. In December of 1957, Doster claimed that he was adjusting better to the work, but he worried that, quote, the pious members of the working force do not control the environment. And he observed that, quote, positive comments were hard to deliver while working. A couple of weeks later, he reported finding himself, quote, unable to speak to the religious questions, statements, and comments brought by other men. In other words, he was reaching almost a state of paralysis. Chrisman, likewise, struggled with himself over his hostile and critical responses to a slower-moving coworker. After a few weeks, he was sharing beers with coworkers after the Friday shift, which we can imagine for a Protestant minister of his class background would have been seen probably as more scandalous than we might think of it today. Campbell's reaction was even more extreme. He became obsessed with the workplace dispute, and though he openly expressed, quote, guilt and resentment on this, Campbell also described, quote, how easily the spirit of revenge grows in himself with regard to other workers, felt that his emotions were much closer to the surface. Slowly, these mainline Protestants were beginning to understand for themselves some of the social, psychological, and cultural dynamics that characterized working class life. The ability of working experiences to shape ideas and behaviors, quote, are not idle observations about others, the Dim ministers insisted. Quote, we have felt them ourselves. Increased pettiness, souring of personality, deadening of creativity, fading self-esteem, heightened tension and temper. They expressed amazement that so many men survived the experience intact. Quote, God is at work, they thought, quote, but not through religion. Of course, what they meant is not through their religion. Not through religion the way they had always defined it. After 3 years of experience, Dim concluded that plant ministers and church ministers were, quote, living in two distinct worlds, worlds which did not seem to intersect in a significant fashion, and worlds which we seemed unable to bring together in meaningful dialogue with the project. The experiment of having plant-based ministers and church-based ministers had reached a breaking point. plant-based ministers like Campbell, Crispin, and Doster accused their fellow mainline Protestants of conflating Christianity as a religion with the American middle class as a culture. Indeed, they took this charge much further. If the paternalistic foreman and the moralistic preacher were two sides of the same coin, then so too was the well-heeled corporate executive just another version of a well-fed bishop. The established mainline church, quote, in which congregations like subsidiary plants feed statistics and money into the mass corporate institution, reflects more inhumanity than humanity, more anonymity than community, more mechanization than militant conviction about life and its meaning. Protestant churches, it seems, were filled with men in gray flanneled suits. Little wonder that workers viewed this religion as an alien, even menacing, cultural force. Dim was ultimately unable to gnaw its way through the dense web of middle-class values to truly share the religious world of the working class. But in making this effort, its ministers left a vital record of workers' cosmologies in mid-20th century. More importantly, Dim's experience reminds historians of the power and importance of class as a historical construct. Too often, historians, especially historians of religion, have been eager to minimize or even ignore class in favor of other socio-historical identities like race, ethnicity, or denomination. Dim illustrates the dangers of this tendency. Indeed, if anything, Dim's ordeal suggests that class is perhaps even more central to shaping religious experience than these other social markers. Historians should pay heed and bring the tools of class analysis more fully into religious studies. Thank you.
So, with that, let me open it up for questions or comments. And as usual, I have my page, but all of you might want to jump in first. Comments or questions?
I was wondering,
just going to grab my water, please.
The change in the nature of the workplace,
mm-hmm.
with the demand on the head, mm-hmm. much more than brawn,
mm-hmm.
how that might change the dynamic.
The role of religion in the workplace, if it was more kind of head-based rather than hand-based. Well, Dim was interested in that too, because one of their way into the factory was through managers, a lot of whom were coming out of Ivy League colleges. So in fact, a lot of the Dim ministers, they knew, they were able to kind of get in to have these little workplace prayer meetings because like their buddy from Princeton is the manager now. And so one of the things that they were trying to do was to sort of connect a managerial level discussion about business ethics, which was, they were really kind of focused on business ethics at that level, with the working people. So I guess what I would kind of say is they weren't quite able to unite those two. But with the more head-based, the way that Dim approached it was that the more managerial or head-based or cognitive type of labor, those are the type of people that are going to be reflecting more on sort of the philosophical or ethical implications of business activity. And I think that they wanted to do that with the people on the assembly line. And from their perspective, that wasn't getting traction. Does that answer your question?
No, I'm no student of nature of work, but I sense this rather dramatic shift from mm-hmm. the physical aspect of work to the
Of work, right.
With essentially the same, I'm not sure why I use the word class.
Mm-hmm.
Same pool of people.
Mm-hmm.
If that then opens some doors that were not open when the breach was
greater. Yeah. Well, I would even, to some extent, I wonder whether or not Dim even overstates the breach. I mean, I think that's the kind of the key question mm-hmm. that I want to know about these sort. I think There clearly were these storefront churches where there was lots of kind of emotional religion. But on the other hand, you know, there are plenty of sources of that I saw. I mean, there was one source, for instance, that is not included in here, from the Dodge Main newspaper that was published out of the Dodge Main factory in Hamtramck. And throughout the mid-1950s, they're talking about the Dodge Main plant as being the only major automobile plant in the world that has Bible reading at lunch break. And this was organized by one of the workers themselves, and he talks about, I got this preacher to come in, and he preached about the veil of life is the veil of tears and how we pass through it. And it's like, theologically, it sounds like the kind of stuff that Dim says is horrible. But the way that it's actually described by workers in the union newspaper is, wasn't this a wonderful, inspiring thing? Which is almost exactly the same thing that you would get from a middle-class church service. So I think to some extent, maybe a grain of salt needs to be taken with the sources.
Dorothy, you had your hand up, and then over to David.
Well, he sort of answered this question, but coming from a, I call it, middle-income background, attending public school, one of the things you were taught at home, stay away from discussions of religion and politics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With mm-hmm. a variety, and that's not the point of public education.
Right.
So it really sort of surprises me that what's going on in the factory.
Yeah, that they would even have conversations about this.
Exactly.
Yeah,
You've been indoctrinated to stay away from this stuff.
Right.
So I guess they just had lunch breaks or something, huh?
They did have lunch breaks. It seems to me, I mean, from the sources that I was able to find, this might have been a kind of generational thing, too, that becomes sort of pronounced in about the mid-50s. And then, you only see traces of it from there. But the Catholic newspaper, for instance, would report, and of course, they want to promote Catholicism. So, but they are just reporting things that that lay people are reporting to them. And they were printing schedules in the Catholic newspaper about all of the different rosary groups that were meeting at the Ford factory.
Yeah, like, again, the public school situation I went through, the Catholic school curriculum went to the ninth grade, and then they transferred. High school. And so maybe
the
first week of class they were discussing religion, but it disappeared.
Right.
Very quickly.
Right.
I've got David and then over to
Jim. Yeah, just because a few of us came up in late, unfortunately, mm-hmm. very, very quickly recap what DIM is.
Yes.
And how it was created.
Yeah. DIM is the acronym for the Detroit Industrial Mission. And this was what became an ecumenical, I guess the modern equivalent would be a nonprofit kind of missionary-ish organization, which was originally created by an Episcopal priest in Detroit, and then later became an ecumenical but heavily Protestant. Later in the 60s, they do actually incorporate a Catholic priest. A Catholic priest joins DIM, but that's nowhere on the radar. In the 1950s, there's a really kind of a sense that, you know, Catholicism and evangelical fundamentalism are both these sort of anti-democratic, autocratic, fatalistic, otherworldly type things. So it's interesting that a Catholic priest joins DIM later. But in the 1950s, you had three pastors that basically formed a pastorate out of a church, and then you had three other pastors that took jobs on assembly lines. And what they were trying to do was to kind of knit together the observations and experiences of the assembly line ministers, and I think probably try to bring the workers into the church, or to illustrate for the work. I think one of the big things they talk about a lot is they want to illustrate for the workers that religion is relevant. There's a real sense of crisis that religion is no longer relevant, and they want to demonstrate the relevance of religion in workers' lives. What I find interesting is that then they go there and they start to scrape the surface and they realize, oh, religion is plenty relevant for a lot of these people. It's just not the religion that we have any way of comprehending.
Do they have any connections to the National Council of Churches or the New York?
I don't think that they were formed. The organization that they were kind of most connected to was the retreat center called Parrishfield here in Michigan. So this was kind of like a retreat center for laity and clergy, and they would kind of go there and have these sort of spiritual retreats and discuss modern theology and that type of thing. And there was a lot of sort of discussing the work of Dym at Parrishfield. And so the Episcopal Church offered some funding, the Presbyterian Church offered some funding. Those national bodies were associated with the National Council of Churches, but I didn't see any that there was a close direct support by the National Council.
I do apologize for coming late. I'd like to ask a preparatory question. Can you offer a little bit of a counterpoint to Dorothy's comment on public schools? The preparatory question is this. Do you have any sense of what percentage of the workers in the plants or areas that you studied came or probably came from rural areas?
I suspect quite a few. Of the workers that Dym is encountering, right? Because they go into this, and this is why this is like a small sliver of the larger project. One of my main things that I try to do in the larger project is to show that Dym's own context for thinking about religion is very narrow, and that in fact they think that they're going to go in and talk about working class religion, i.e., Protestant mainline religion, and it will just kind of plop into the work. Well, in fact, I mean, in a place like Detroit, the majority of religious workers were Catholic, the next largest were African American, and it's the third largest that are Protestant. And all, very few of them are mainline Protestant. So they're kind of fatally flawed from the get-go in terms of how they're going to think about what working class religion is. Of those southern migrants, I mean, I haven't done like census data level stuff, but the impression from the social science literature that I see is the vast majority of these people were coming during the 1940s to World War II jobs, and often would circle back. They would sometimes seasonally move back to Kentucky or Tennessee. Maybe they had some land there, and then would sometimes come back to supplement that with factory work.
Okay, here's my counterpoint to Dorothy's comment. I too grew up in a public school system, but the first 6 grades plus kindergarten were in a one-room country schoolhouse, rural northern Kent County, and grew up on a farm in Truslow. So there's I've never heard the idea of keeping religion and politics out of the schools until some junior high or high school. We had, sometimes the teacher would offer a prayer. The Bible was in our education, in a peripheral way a lot of times. But the thing that was I most remember about that one country school experience is that once a month, very regularly, for several years, most of the years I was there, that we would have a call and a visit, accepted and welcomed, by Mr. DeVries, who worked with something like an educational version of the Gideons. Mm-hmm. He'd come in and he'd make a presentation, and sometimes very biblically based, and sometimes he would have things for us that were that were related to that. So that's why I asked the question about rural backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anybody coming into that factory from a rural background isn't going to, most likely, is not going to, especially from the South.
Especially from the South.
With a sense of separation of say politics, which can encompass work, and religion and workplace.
Yeah, the Detroit Council of Churches, which was which was kind of the Detroit level of the National Council of Churches. So again, very kind of mainline Protestant organizations. They actually wrote some reports that I saw from about the 1940s to the 50s, in which they express they're working through the conflicts that they have with both Catholics and other rural Protestants, and they express exactly the sentiment that we have a very different understanding of the relationship between religion and the public sphere with these other people, They were the Detroit Council of Churches was using this as a way to say we need to be more involved in social services, because with the Catholics, for instance, they don't see the same clear division
between church and state, and so they see it as just natural that they're going to be doing all of these kind of quasi-state functions via education, welfare, that type of thing. So yeah, I think part of it would be sort of what was the specific class or religious background that they were coming from. I think probably the Detroit Industrial Mission folks, in their background, they probably felt that people don't talk enough about religion in the real world, whereas the people that were actually coming from the Appalachian, yeah, it's just common, you know, that's just the dominant culture. So I think there might have been kind of conflicting notions of what constitutes appropriate discussion of religion in public life.
Yeah, let me hit you with a, because you mentioned Goldwater. It just so happens that the parallel to this group are the communists who colonized the plants in earlier decades. Right? And even the New Left folks who went in the 1960s, again, being college trained, going in, believing that they were bringing the message to the workers.
Yeah, right.
To what degree was in Detroit Industrial Mission self-aware of the fact that there were other competing ideologies besides religion? That is, were they worried, for example, about general secularism? Were they worried about communism and other stuff, given the fact that this is Cold War Detroit?
Yeah, absolutely. They were deeply worried about every religious group, not just the Detroit Industrial Mission. For instance, there's a Catholic labor group, which again, this is one of the odd sort of odd things. I mean, the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists is established in 1938. In 1957, they renamed themselves. I don't know if you know this history. They secede from the national organization of the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists and renamed themselves the Detroit Catholic Labor Conference, specifically because they say that the national organization has put too much emphasis on sort of top-down fiat, right? So they say, we want to develop independent Catholic thinking. It's almost a precursor of the kind of Vatican II, post-Vatican II style Catholicism. You would think that the Detroit Industrial Mission would be interested in what's going on in Detroit labor circles, but I couldn't find any evidence that they communicated at all. But to get to your point, like the Detroit Catholic Labor Conference, the Detroit Archdiocese, in the Michigan Chronicle, the African American paper where they constantly had church pages published, they're all terrified of secularism.
But what about that? Since given the fact that God was communism.
Yeah, right. So the religion is the bulwark against communist incursions. You know, that's true, although I guess I detected more specifically anti-communist worries earlier. And in the 1950s, that was kind of background noise, and secularism itself seemed to be the main concern.
Well, it very well may be that they feel that they already, in effect, beat communism in Detroit. You had the Detroit hearings of Hugh Ackland and everybody else earlier, so it very well may be that that's regarded.
I think they probably feel that they won the ideological battle, but they were losing the battle against materialism itself. So I think they saw secular material values winning in a kind of covert way, and that's they were very concerned about that.
Other questions? Let me hit you with another, just because I've gotten this, which is, you know, I always teach, if I'm teaching labor history, about the difference between the Protestant work ethic and the Catholic. And I always remember the Catholic work ethic to be one that work is a curse, and that's why there's some saints days that you take off, including St. Monday.
Yeah. No, that's a good theory.
So the notion of the rise of the Protestant work ethic is a reaction to that kind of ebullient over-drinking and everything else, which finds that meaning in work, right? Work not necessarily as curse, but work as you say, joy, or at least idle hands of the devil's workshop.
Yeah,
what I was always taught.
Right.
So, to what degree? Tell us a little more. I think you it sounds like gang warfare. You've got Catholics, you've got evangelical Southerners
of either Pentecostal or fundamentalist. I mean, they're not the same thing.
Right. So then you've also got your African Americans who are struggling for. I mean, even though they are Baptists like other Baptists, they're not Baptists like other Baptists. So how did the Detroit Industrial Mission, how did it deal with, for example, the presence of blacks who were also Episcopalians or also Methodists or also Baptists and so forth?
Largely by ignoring them in the 50s, but the experience changes very, very quickly in the early 60s. The people of DIM are people you would probably describe as 50s era Cold War liberals. You know, I mean, these are people who probably were going to vote for Kennedy in 1960. You know, they weren't radical, but they were liberal. And so they were concerned about race, but they weren't really personally invested in racial issues. So in the publications that DIM has a variety of publications of, like, how do you do an industrial mission, and like really kind of fascinating, like, workshop type stuff. So like, if you're leading an industrial mission, how do you workshop between different types of workers and the managers? And they would have like little dramatic scenarios that they might like play out. And in a handful of them, there would be like the token African American to illustrate or stand in for the Negro problem. It doesn't really get beyond that in the 50s. But by the early 60s, there's kind of splinter movements coming off of DIM that they decide that they want to do the same thing that DIM tried in the factory, only they want to do it in the inner city. And so they start like seating these Protestant ministers in tough urban neighborhoods. And the journals of these people are incredible. So these guys are hanging out at CORE rallies, Congress of Racial Equality. They're going to the marches. They're hanging out with C.L. Franklin in C.L. Franklin's Baptist Church. They're reporting the internecine struggles between the various generations of African American leaders and how religious that movement is going to be. There's one guy who was an eyewitness to Martin Luther King's march in 1963. That preceded the March on Washington by a month. And they say the same type of thing about race as the DIM people are saying about class. So in 1959, the DIM ministers and the planters are saying, oh, we're totally learning all this incredible stuff about how class really exists. And 3 or 4 years later, the ministers in the inner city are saying, holy smokes, this is like a revolution on race. And then at that point, they become, the focus really shifts. And in fact, all of the workplace and class stuff gets tossed out the window and gets replaced with a focus on race and racial justice. And the work stuff just kind of dries up and blows away.
Time is short, and you can answer this yes or no.
No, time is not short. But
oh, okay. All right. I'm hearing echoes of some of the things that Reinhold Niebuhr did. Mm-hmm. Run into any links between DIM, any groups like it, reaching back to Niebuhr? I think he was
certainly, yeah. Niebuhr.
Detroit by the time.
He was way gone. He was gone by the end of the 20s.
By the end of the 20s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, but you're right that Niebuhr was in Detroit in the 20s, and the first kind of major thing that Niebuhr wrote for the Christian Century, which was kind of the big liberal Protestant magazine, was a critique of Henry Ford. Henry Ford.
Of Henry Ford.
Yes.
Ford.
No. He wrote a pretty, at the time, a very controversial critique of Henry Ford and Fordism. And he served as, what was it called, like the industrial relations chair of the Detroit Council of Churches. Detroit Council of Churches was formed, I think, 1919, right after World War I. And for a little while, they've got a little subgroup that is trying to deal with industrial and labor issues. It, from what I can tell, was very milquetoast and ineffectual. And Niebuhr himself, in his first memoir, Leaves from a Notebook of a Tame Cynic, he writes about his experiences in Detroit, and he himself bemoans how milquetoast the Detroit Council of Churches was, although he also criticizes the AFL. He says they're too timid, too. He says, dealing with the AFL is like dealing with the village bankers. So yes, there was, within Detroit, and in fact, the unknown figure here, who nobody has really, I mean, I've looked through his papers, there's not a lot there, but what's his name? Not Claude Williams, the Episcopal bishop in 1918-1919. Charles Williams. Anybody heard of Charles Williams? Charles Williams forms this group called the Church League for Industrial Democracy, right? And he serves on the Interchurch World Report that investigates the steel strike in 1919, which is like one of the great sources in all of labor history, right? I don't think he's in Michigan for that long. This Church League for Industrial Democracy, it kind of like it's founded in Detroit. It explodes. I don't know what happens to it. I can't find any records after it. But I mean, so anyway, all the way back to 1917, 1918, 1919, there are antecedents of this type of stuff. But as I said, I don't see the DIM has any real awareness that they are coming out of a history.
Well, I think what I'm struck by in your talk, Matt, is that these guys, when they go to church on Sunday, they're sitting next to the supervisors and managers of those plants.
Yeah.
They're not sitting next to those workers.
And they say that. And they say that when, in the odd case when a worker comes to the church, that he is made to feel like he doesn't belong. Like that there's such a consciousness of that person and of the congregation towards that person that like this is a country club church. You don't really belong here. That was one of the things that they had hoped to do away with by their what they called the experiment, which again is a very kind of progressive era type phrase. I don't know why they weren't making these connections to progressive era, you know, like social experiments. As far as I can tell, they weren't. But no, it's true. It's the congregations themselves were pretty class segregated, and obviously were mostly, if not all, race segregated.
You know, Charles, to your point, I think that one thing that's interesting is that this is right before the crisis in the auto factories. The crisis in the auto factories over the issue of head and hand doesn't really happen until 1968, 1969. You know, when you begin to get Beta vets going into the plants and you also get a lot of people colonizing from the New Left and others in that period, then people start worrying about the quality of employment, quality of work life, the employee involvement, and everything else. I think this might be, right at this point, is right when you're actually at the triumph of post-World War II managerialism and real machine control. Mm-hmm. I think these guys are the height of all those organizations. I think Eli Genoy's
it's right at that time.
Comes right out of this time on dehumanization.
There's one called The Man on the Assembly Line. Yeah. It was a major study that they cite. Yeah. And they're always quoting Eli Genoy in their reports. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of it is really, they're not recognizing yet, but having been a factory worker, not an auto worker, but you know, the funny thing about it is you have plenty of time to think on the line when you're not doing thinking work, right? I mean, in fact, chances are these guys, if they could touch a rosary, could have done it, right? Or could have talked religion over the top of the din if possible, just because there's a lot of time, thinking time, in dehumanized work. Mm-hmm. I mean, which really seems funny, but I think it really is true. Other comments or questions for Matt about
and
all this?
I think this generation, these DIM ministers, I mean, I kind of feel for them because in a way, they're almost born at the wrong time. You know, they're born in between, they're not the New Dealers, you know, they're not coming in the 30s, and they're not New Leftists. They're too young to be New Leftists, and they're too old to be New Dealers. And so they're these kind of, you know, they're kind of looking for, well, so how do we bring liberalism that isn't radicalism, that is informed by the new ideas of the post-World War II world? But they don't really have, I don't think they have the same sort of generational or cultural framework.
But you said it, but aren't they closer to World War I kind of era?
Progressive era types?
Yeah, progressive era types or even earlier. I mean, these are religious uplift folks.
They are kind of really, well.
Aren't they, from what you said?
I don't think so. I don't know, maybe in practice, but that's they really eschew that language. They really talk about dialogue and conversation and experience and sharing the experience. You know, they're not talking about like we want to. I don't really use that kind of uplift. I think what they want to do is to create a kind of dialogue
a space
that creates deeper ties between people. And I think that they just don't realize going into it that the ties are much thinner than they think they are.
And not to make too fine a point on this, but if any of you have never seen in your life Barney Bipple and the Magic Dandelions, you have to see it for what I'm about to say.
Okay.
So Barney Bipple is given 3 magic dandelions by a neighbor lady who might be a witch. And so one of the things he asks for is he wants to be able to have his dog speak. So his dog speaks. And his dog looks at him, and Barney B wants to know what's been on the mind of his dog. And his dog says, you know, I wish that you were getting a higher quality dog food, because this dog food is so bad. So, I mean, I think that the class analysis might be that these Detroit Industrial Mission guys didn't realize really how unclass conscious they were.
That's
trying to become class conscious.
Yes, that is. I think that is. I think as that first report of theirs that I quoted, where they had this very they even have a moment of self-reflection where they say, maybe this sounds too romantic to say that we're marching out heroically with all the other workers after work in the gates, and then pretty soon they're saying, yeah, that was really a rosy kind of expectation that we had about what this was going to be like.
Well, I mean, in the late 1800s, as you all know, I mean, you get all these public debates, and everyone's in on the Negro question,
right.
The labor question,
right.
the woman question.
Right.
Right. It sounds like these guys, in fact, are taking that to 1959.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Other questions or comments for Matt? Well, let's give Matt a round of applause.
Thank you.